Did you get a book?
Yeah.
Would you like?
Yes, please.
Anybody else snag one?
Okay.
Hey.
Good morning, everybody. We're about a minute early, but I think it looks like we're pretty much all here, so we'll go ahead and get started. Does everybody have a book? If you don't, please come up and grab one. You can open up another one of these. You've got to make sure that you have your American Heritage reader, especially to complement your Western Heritage reader. Good fire. All right. So, good morning. This is American Heritage 105, Section 6. That's right. So, I sent everybody a syllabus yesterday or 2 days ago, so hopefully you all got that via email. If you didn't, just let me know. I can resend that, but you should have been on the list for that. I may have missed somebody typed in. Okay, so this class, obviously everything we do is going to be based on this book here, American Heritage, and you do have that other book that's been assigned to you. In fact, for our class, we have two other books, but you have the book Tyndall and She, 10th Brief Edition. I will be referring to that, but not a lot. You certainly don't have to bring it to class by any means at all. In fact, but you do always, I would like you to have this at all times. So always make sure that you bring this one. The other book that I've assigned to you is a book that you'll find online, and I gave you the URL for that. I think I'm the only person who does this, but I promise you'll like it. Your first paper will be based on it. It's a play that I want you to read called Cato, a Tragedy. And when you go to the website, they'll have the full book, and the full book is maybe 400 pages or something. The play is only 94 pages, and it's a play. You can read it in probably 2 hours. So it's not going to take you long. I think it's pages 5 through 99, if I remember, in that you don't need to read the preface or the commentary, just the play. And I'll talk about the play as we get closer to it. I would like you to start reading it now, and we'll talk about it. I'll have some of you take parts, and we'll read it in class probably in about 3 weeks, maybe third week, right? So in about 2 weeks. One of the reasons I want you to read it, it's a great Republican play, small r Republican, a proponent of a republic. But it's also really good because it was George Washington's favorite play. He had it memorized and he had it performed probably 7 times at the winter at Valley Forge. So this is, and you'll see the characters. There are things like, "I'm sorry I only have but one life to give for my country." A lot of lines that you associate with the American founding are all from this play, and it was because it was the most popular play in America. So you also have to keep something in mind. We'll see this today when we look at the Puritans. Plays were not well regarded in America prior to the Civil War. And of course, in the Civil War, our president gets killed in a play. So it didn't have a lot of fame there either. But people who went to plays prior to the Civil War were usually seen as atheists because playing was, it means liturgy. Liturgy play. If you were a Protestant, a serious Protestant, going to a play meant you were practicing Catholicism, which was basically atheism. So that's why it was so shunned. And the fact that Washington, of course, he's an Anglican, so he doesn't really care about that, but the fact that he embraced that play is really significant because that would have hurt his political career a lot during his day and age. So I realize now we would never, we're so inundated with Netflix and everything, but that idea of performing is very new in terms of it being acceptable by most of society. So we'll talk about that a little bit more. But I do want you to read the play, and I think you'll really enjoy it. There are a lot of things going on in it. There's a lot of Roman Stoicism. It's, even though it's about ancient Rome, it's really about a modern republic, as you'll see pretty quickly. So I think you'll like that. But just make sure that you look up that URL and start reading that as soon as you can. For today, the only thing I'm going to assign to you, I shouldn't say only, it's not a small bit, but I would like you to read what we have in the reader, in the American Heritage Reader. I'd like you to read up through the Capitol Laws on page 33. So for Friday, make sure you've read the Laws of Virginia up through the Capitol Laws, and then we'll probably get into Pennsylvania and Virginia too. So by Monday, I'd like you to finish the colonial section that we have there, the colonial heritage. It's not, I like the colonial stuff, but if we're not going to spend a lot of time on it, we've got to get up to Obama or Trump, and there are just certain places we're going to have to kind of fudge because we just can't do all of this, but I'll do as much as we can. Colonial is not a place I really want to linger, though it's fascinating, but I think we can get through it fairly quickly. So just make sure for Friday, again, that you've read up through the Capitol Laws, and then for Monday that you finish that section. So, but we may get to it faster than that. We'll see. Okay, so in this class, in the syllabus, I don't want to spend too much time about this, but if you have questions, of course, ask me. In the syllabus itself, you've got just basically two major forms of grades. You've got your three papers that you're writing for this class, and I've already given you the topics. Those topics are never definitive topics. They're not absolutes. They're just starting points. So don't feel like you have to answer the question I asked you in the prompt. Those are just ways of kind of getting you started, and wherever you take it from there is fine. So I will be grading you on style. I'll be grading you on argument. I'll be grading you on format. But I'm not going to be grading you on your opinion or how you arrived at your conclusion, except to see the logic and the sources that you used to get there. So those papers are, I won't say they're a free-for-all by any means. I take them seriously. But in terms of topics, just do something that you really want, as long as it's something similar to what I have, something very close into that, those topics themselves. So the idea of the Republic in terms of this first paper, and then on democracy, and then on modernity, as we'll see the three parts of the class. But the first one is the only one you need to worry about right now, and that is reading that play and start thinking about what it means to live in a republic. So that's the most important thing, but you can take the question in a lot of different ways. As you'll see when you get into the play, if you want to focus on Cato, that's fine. If you're interested in the love triangles that are going on, that's fine too. My wife tells me they're important. After reading this play for 20 years, I still don't get the love triangles, but I guess they're important. So I know that there are things in them that can be argued, and there have been a lot of great papers written about what's going on, and you'll see why, because virtue and love get challenged one to another. That is, personal love versus love for the Republic are challenged. So those papers are really meant to be ways for me to see where you're at in terms of writing. So not really much more than that. You're not doing historical research. Everything you need to do is right here in the book. You can always take from something else that's common knowledge, but you don't need to go research at the library. The other set of grades, which is much, much bigger, are your two midterms and your final. So I guess a third term would be the proper way of saying it. So I think you'll have your first midterm in about 5 weeks, and then you'll have your second one in 10 weeks, and then your final. Of course, those are your big grades. And it'll be 50 minutes, and then obviously 2 hours for the final. And I've already given you the final questions on the syllabus, so you can start thinking about the kinds of things that I'm going to be asking in here. And I think it'll be pretty obvious. This is definitely a continuation of H104, but now we're looking at, you know, a much shorter time span, 400 years, 500 years, as opposed to 4,000 years in Western heritage. And we're comparing people, you know, some interesting people, but obviously Andrew Jackson, as interesting as he might be, is not nearly as interesting as St. Augustine. That's just a fact. So we're going to be very narrow, but we're also going to see, all right, all these great ideas we talked about in Western heritage, what actually happens when we try and make them real in American heritage. This class, and I have to warn you, it's just the way it is, this class gets really depressing towards the end. Because we're going to start, you know, colonial period's fascinating, and then we get to the revolution, which is just, you know, like the high point of all history, and then it kind of goes down from there. So I just want to warn you, by the time we get to the 20th century, we're going to have Nazis and commies running around. They're not fun. I mean, they're evil people. So you know, the world really goes to hell in the 20th century, and there's nothing we can do about that. We're just going to have to talk about it and just warn you. Yeah, we will end on a high note, I promise. But it'll be, you know, every day you guys will be coming in wondering what new atrocity we'll be talking about for about the last five classes. And then the last class will be like, yeah, but it'll take a bit to get there. It's where we're at in the world. The world is a very, very, very different place than when I graduated from college in 1990. You know, it's a very different place. So, yeah, I feel sorry for you, but it's also, it is what it is. So, we'll get to that. Okay, so, any questions on the syllabus or the course, what we're going to do? Course is divided into three parts, as I said. We'll look at the Republican aspect of America, then the Democratic aspect, that's the 19th century, and then the 20th century, the ideological aspect. So, Republic, Democracy, Ideology, as we'll see it. Okay, everybody cool on grades, everything? Yes.
Are all the exams just over that, like, third of the class, or are they...
Yeah, so the first exam will only be on the first third. The second exam, I'll give you a study guide, and it will be partly on the first part and partly on the second, because when we're thinking about the democracy, it's pretty hard to look at it without comparing it to what it had been earlier. And then the final will be comprehensive. But again, I'll give you study guides for each of those, and I'll have an extra... We'll have an evening study session for each of the courses, for each of the exams. That's totally voluntary if you want to come or not, but I'll set those up so we can talk about those too. So what's your name?
Christina.
Good, thank you. That's great. Okay, anybody else on this? All right, good. Okay, so colonial America and where we come in. So when we look at colonial America, there are a number of things to keep in mind. We're going to go back to 1492 for a moment, but not for long. I want you to think about what it would have been like to have been, say, a European, maybe even Christopher Columbus, who's relatively upper middle class, which would have been very rare at the time, but to have come out of the medieval period, which had in its own way in Europe an incredible confidence about itself. Not an arrogance. Part of the medieval confidence was exactly the opposite of arrogance. It was this idea, if you remember from, and I realize it's a long time for some of you, but if you remember back to Western heritage, you know, these are people who, whether they lived 40 years or 60 years, they firmly believed that their life here was transitory. So you do penance and you get to heaven. That was life. And whether we agree with the theology or not, there was a real stability in the Middle Ages, an incredible stability. And people were generally, believe it or not, satisfied. I wouldn't call them happy, but they were satisfied. They knew what their lot in life was. If you built a cathedral, you knew it took 200 years to build it. So when you build it, it's going to be your great-great-great-great-grandchildren who actually enjoy it. And then suddenly all kinds of things happen. We have the plague, which wipes out much of Europe in the 1300s. And then we have this regrowth where people are repopulating. It takes 300 years. We won't. It'll be 1660 before the European population is back to the pre-plague level. So you've got the plague that comes in. But after that, during the recovery, a lot of things change. Probably the most important change is, of course, the discovery of being able to get around the southern tip of Africa and being able to access Asia by sea, but then also to discover the New World, which they don't know is a New World at first. They think they're in Asia, actually India, we always, you know, or Japan. They think that they've discovered that. Columbus never knows that he's discovered a New World. But regardless, he does. And in that discovery, of course, think about what changes. You've got this population in Europe that is struggling to come back after the plague. We're only, when Columbus arrives in North America, or in the Caribbean, when he arrives in the Americas, they've only been recovering from the plague for 100 years. And so there's still a huge desire to find new land. Plus, you've got other factors. The Muslims have been attacking through Italy. They've been attacking through Turkey and what's now Constantinople, or what's now Istanbul, formerly Constantinople. And you've got them attacking in Spain and the Spanish rebuffing them. So not only is the European population trying to recover, they're under siege all the time. And then you discover this new world. And that new world, there's just, no matter how much we want to downplay it or play it up, I don't think we could ever exaggerate its importance enough. This idea that in the middle of struggle, you're given this whole new two continents. So now, of course, in 2019, we think it's politically incorrect because we think about Europeans who come over and oppress the Indians. But imagine, I forget the politics for a moment, imagine for a moment in that struggle, you discover this vast new land, huge, that seems generally unpopulated to you. And at times it wasn't populated, and we'll talk about that in a moment. Obviously, there are a lot of Indians here, so to say it's unpopulated is ridiculous. But there are aspects, there are areas that seem unpopulated, and the pilgrims will discover one of those places at Plymouth Colony. So you've got this vast new land. It means, of course, that not only can you reclaim land in Europe because of the plague, but now you've got this whole new land elsewhere that is terra incognita. You don't even know how far it's going to go, how big it is. In fact, we, as Americans, we take this for granted now. We had not even mapped North America until the 1870s. So we, as Americans, but here we are, we're only 150 years after the United States had finally been mapped. And you know, that's, we can all pull up our Google Maps and Apple Maps, and we see it instantly, but it's only been a century and a half that we've had this thing mapped. So it's going to take a very, almost 400 years to map North and South America. South America will take a little bit longer, but not much, about another 20 years than it does in North America. So it's going to take a while to map all of these things. Then you have these other radically drastic changes, things that we all take for granted. North America and South America are the home to the potato and the tomato. And can we, any of us in here imagine Irish culture without a potato? Or could we imagine Italian culture without the tomato? And that may sound trivial, but it's not. It's hugely beneficial to the Europeans because it means for the first time in European history, Northern Europeans, Germans, Scandinavians, Irish, the English, they can actually have the same caloric intake. They can get the same calories that the Mediterraneans have been having for centuries. And it means that the whole balance of power in Europe can change. Because now you actually can have enough food for a large population in places like Sweden. You could never have done that in 1300 unless you raid, right? Which is exactly what the Vikings were doing. Yeah, they have to raid, and even there it's small. Yeah, you can imagine you may have 100 guys out on a raid, but you can only take so much back to the population. That's not a long-term strategy. Raids are usually one-time goals, one-time end games, and it's over. So all of this is going to change. And it does, it's going to play into the Reformation. It's going to play into the rise of national enmity, all kinds of things going on in Europe. Other discoveries, gunpowder. It's been around forever in Asia, but the Asians had never really used it for weapons. In the same way the Greeks had developed a steam engine, ancient Greeks had, but they only thought of it as something for toys, to move toys around. They'd never thought of a large-scale application. Same thing with American Indians. They developed a wheel, but it was only for children's toys. They'd never thought, what do we do with this thing? Chinese the same way. They had gunpowder for thousands of years. Europeans get it, and they think, wow, this is great. There's a little bit of pyromania in all Europeans. They think this is fantastic. Let's put 100 of these things together and see what happens. They start blowing up castles. So it changes everything. All of this discovery of the new world, navigation techniques, new food, new weapons, all of this is going to change everything. And Europe, as we think of it today, really starts about 1520, right at that point, right when Martin Luther is really going against the Catholic Church. That is really the moment of modern Europe. So if any of us were betting people and we had looked at the world in 1400, not one sane person in here would have said, yep, by 2019, Europeans will be ascendant over the world. There's nobody in their right mind would have done that. We may have put our money on the Chinese. Nobody would have put their money on the Europeans. And yet, there's the European miracle, this vast, vast growth that happens. But out of that, of course, comes all kinds of conflict. And for us, the most important conflict is specifically the Reformation conflict. So as America is being settled, really from 1520 on, which is, we're not going to have much settlement of North or South America prior to this. It's going to happen almost all after the Reformation. Once the Reformation begins, and it begins in January 1521, about 4 years after Luther posts his theses, once it begins, you're going to have division after division after division within Europe. And that also means that various peoples are going to be taking sides. And it's not us or them. It's not generally Protestant versus Catholic. That can be it. But it's also Protestant versus Protestant. So you're going to have a lot of anxiety in the 16th century in Europe, and people really taking sides, and there are a lot of sides. So for our purposes in this class, you know, we could talk, obviously, you know, the Catholics are trying to settle through France, and they're trying to settle through the Spanish. So you've got Catholic settlement throughout Latin America and throughout the middle part of North America up to Quebec through the French. So they're going to be settling. But for our purposes, because in this class we're most concerned with the English heritage of America, yeah, that's good and bad, but because that's what we're most concerned with, we're going to be thinking about what's happening in the Church of England in particular, and what matters for the Church of England and those people who are either within it fully or dissenting from it in some way. But I do have to stress this, and you know, whatever your own religious preferences are, it doesn't really fit into this, just so you know, just to be as objective as possible. America, the United States, so when we look at the Mayflower Compact, which we'll do in a few minutes, when we look at the Declaration or the Constitution or the Bill of Rights, these are utterly Protestant documents. And there's just no getting around that. If you're Jewish or Catholic, I apologize, but Jews and Catholics are outsiders. This is absolutely a Protestant country in its beginning. And it is defined by its Protestantism. And unlike Europeans who get over the Reformation fairly quickly, yet to this day, I mean, look at Britain. Nobody in Britain really cares about Christianity anymore. They did 20 years ago, but that's pretty much died now. Yeah, America, we're bizarre. Yeah, Europeans, for those of you, if you had exchange students, for example, in high school, or if you've gone abroad, you know, Europeans, one of their favorite things to do when they visit America is drive around Sunday mornings and look at church parking lots. They think that's hilarious. Because nobody goes to church in Europe. And they drive around in America and they see parking lots are full, church parking lots all over America. It's hilarious. And they don't care. Right? Europeans don't care about religion anymore in the way that we do. Americans are deeply religious, even when we're not religious. Our culture is so shaped by our religiosity. And that's one of the most important differences between us and modern Europeans. They don't get us because we are still so incredibly religious. And we always have been. There's never been a point in our history where the majority of Americans were not practicing in some way. But it's not going to be Catholic until 1846. Right, so we're not going to have any serious Catholicism or Judaism or Eastern Orthodoxy until the 19th century. So when we're talking about this first part of America, really America begins in 1620. Jamestown's fine, but it's an aberration. America really begins with Plymouth Rock. So when we think about that settlement, we won't have anything other than Protestants having any influence at all, except for, you get a few Marylanders who are Catholic who will have some influence, but we remember them because there are about three of them. So we're not going to have any serious influence other than Protestantism until 1846, when the Irish and the Germans and the Scandinavians come in. And then, of course, it'll be divided between Catholics and Lutherans, but Lutherans aren't regarded as Protestant in the 19th century. They're seen as kind of a form of Catholicism. So just keep all of that in mind. So I want you to understand these are deeply a reformational people. So one historian who's himself not a believer at all, this great scholar, J.C.D. Clark, you don't even know his name, but he actually argues that the American Revolution is the final battle of the European Reformation. And there's a lot of truth in that. That's an exaggeration, but there's a lot of truth. So when New Englanders, for example, I'll tell you guys this again when we get to the Revolution, but during the American Revolution, you guys, I hope you know our army, our Continental Army, is almost strictly New Englanders. And we have hardly any Southerners in the army, even though Washington's a Southerner, he's the general. The Continental Army is a New England army. But when they go into battle, their war cry, and think about this for a moment, this is the spirit of 76, their war cry is no king and no pope. That's what they yell as they go into battle against the British, as if the British were going to bring the Pope in. But that's what they're yelling, and that tells you how reformational they really are. They are deeply Protestant. So we have to ask why. What is it that gives them this character, and why are other peoples, and to a certain degree to this day, why are Catholics and Jews still kind of outsiders in all of this? So that's changed, obviously, but there's still a bit of that. So if we look at the Reformation, we're going to look specifically at the American colonies and what happens. This is a way to kind of think about how this Reformation in England plays out and what it means for us. So obviously, and I hope you guys all remember this, though, again, for some of you, this has been a while. If you remember in 1543, get that right? 1534, sorry. Little dyslexic. In 1534, Parliament passes, because Henry VIII forces them to, they pass what's called the Act of Supremacy. So we're in England now. Henry VIII is forced through this Act of Supremacy, and its main goal, which it succeeds in, is to overturn the Magna Carta. So if you remember the Magna Carta, 1215, again, I realize it's been a while, but if you remember the Magna Carta, points 1 and 63, the first point and the final point of the Magna Carta, was that the government, the king, may never in any way interfere with the affairs of the church. It's totally, the English church is free. What that meant was it could be Catholic, but you can't have politics interfering with it. Henry comes in, and there's a whole history behind that, but Henry comes in. And even though he started off as a great Catholic, he rejects Catholicism. And he overturns the Magna Carta. So the Act of Supremacy says, it's literally what the title is, the king is supreme over the church, over the English church. So it's an absolute undoing of the Magna Carta. And when Henry does that, he, of course, makes a whole new church. This is brand new. So we now call it the Church of England, or the Anglican Church. But you can imagine what kind of division that would create. So at the time that Henry creates the church in 1534, it would be today's Episcopalian and Anglican churches, right? That's the origin. But by the time Henry creates that, you've already got Calvin, or at least Calvinistic ideas that are being argued. You've got Luther, and you've got all kinds of people debating the Reformation. So if England had done this before Luther, which is hard to imagine, but you might actually have a solid way of thinking, a solid theology. But now it's too divided. It's creating something in the middle of chaos. And so the English church did whatever it could. Again, those of you who remember, they used the term a via media. That is the in-between way, or the third way, the in-between. And the via media meant that the English church would be neither Catholic nor Protestant, but something else. It would be a third thing. And to this day, 2019 is still a problem for the Church of England. They're still trying to figure out what they are. Are they Catholic or are they Protestant? And they don't know. That's very hard for them. And understandably, because it's a hybrid, they're trying to figure out exactly what's going on here. But that means you're also going to have within this a lot of divisions. People who want it to go one way or another. And so the biggest divide that comes in the church over the next 100-150 years in England, and they're going to have a whole civil war over this. The king's going to lose his head. So by the time we get into the early 1600s, the real divide, there aren't really Catholics anymore. It's illegal to be Roman Catholic. But there are people who still believe in Catholic theology, even if they don't accept the Pope. So you've still got a lot of these people around. And these people who have a more Catholic leaning, we might call them Anglo-Catholics, just to make it, rather than Roman Catholics, to kind of simplify it. These Anglo-Catholics almost always, interestingly enough, side with the king. So they almost always side with the king in debates. Anyone want to take a guess why? Why would they side with the king? Obviously, the king, 100 years earlier, had killed a bunch of Catholics and done away with the Catholic Church, so why would it be 100 years later that those who are pro-Catholic, or at least pro-Catholic theology, support the king? Anybody know what's going on? Why would they do that? Yeah, what's your name?
Patrick.
Patrick, thanks.
Like some understanding of divine right.
Okay, you've got divine right, right? That's a huge element in all of this. 1528 is the first time divine right of kings has been put into play, right? So you've got that. What else? When Henry takes over in 1534, if the whole country's Catholic and he gets rid of the Catholic Church, what's he going to have? What's going to happen to the property, the church property? Where are all these new? What's going to happen? How's he going to gain support? It's not easy to overthrow an entire church. It's really hard, actually. It's going to get very, very bloody very quickly. So who are these guys who are supporting the king? They're all the new nobility. And so when he gets rid of the old Catholics, he has to get rid of the old nobility. And he takes the church property and he gives it to his people, people he likes. So Patrick owned it when we were Catholic, but now that we've overthrown the Catholic Church, we give it to Nathaniel. And Nathaniel becomes the new lord. And so he owes all of his allegiance to the crown, not to Parliament. So it's a weird inversion in which those who were sympathetic to Catholicism, or at least Catholic theology, even though the king had been their enemy, they now turn around and support the king because it's a new aristocracy. Does that make sense for everyone? Okay, so these people in England, and you'll see why this is so important for us, these people are called Cavaliers. And as Cavaliers, they would distinguish themselves. They're all aristocratic. But there are two things we can say absolutely about the Cavaliers. They almost all go to Oxford. Oxford is always the Anglican school, in fact, the high Anglican school, Church of England school. And they are also almost always very fashionable in the sense of whatever the latest fashion is. And that's why when we look back at paintings from the 17th century at the English, they all have hair like guys in the 80s who were in metal bands had. And they've got these huge, huge, huge hair things that they're wearing, huge wigs, because they print and preen. And they always, this is very important, when they go out in public, they're wearing the best clothes and they have a massive hair, even if they've all got wigs. And that tradition is there. So these are Cavaliers. On the other side, you get a whole bunch of people who are basically, but if you're a real Calvinist, you'll kind of cringe at this, but they consider themselves Calvinists. And they call themselves, not Cavaliers, but Puritans. And as Puritans, they want to purify the Church of England. They don't want to leave it, generally. They want to purify it of Catholic influences. So these are the Puritans. They want to purify the Church of England. They do not have access to the king. They don't like the king. They hate the king. And what do we know about these guys? Well, two things again, just like the Cavaliers. Unlike going to Oxford, they almost all go to Cambridge. So almost all the Puritans are at Cambridge, and all the Anglicans are at Oxford. And to show that they're not Cavaliers, all the men shave their heads. So they're called roundheads. And I'm not joking. They put bowls on their heads and cut it. So they look like medieval monks. Now, they'd probably kill you if you said that to them, but that's exactly what they're doing. So they're the roundheads. Now, let me just ask you, for those of you who know what's going on, we got a civil war. We're going to have a massive civil war in the 1640s. Bloody, brutal civil war, as bad as our civil war. We've got the roundheads and the Cavaliers just tearing each other apart. This is the 1640s. If you're a roundhead and you're scared that the Anglicans are going to take over, where do you go? Where's your safety valve? You're a roundhead, you're a Puritan. You think the king could win, which is a high possibility. Here's Charles. Right? He's got his huge armies. He's trying to take out all the Puritans. Yeah.
Scotland.
Yeah, that's a good guess. You could, right? Because of the Presbyterians, and you've got Knox up there and his followers. But that's still pretty close to home, right? That's really close to home. So, Shelby.
America.
Yeah, where in America? Where do the Puritans go? Guys, think about this. What did we celebrate on Thanksgiving? Anybody in here, say, dress up as a Georgian for Thanksgiving? Right? And eat grits? And what do we do on Thanksgiving? We have turkey, cranberry. Anybody, where do you grow cranberries? There's only one place in the U.S. you can grow cranberries effectively. Yeah.
New England.
Yeah, Massachusetts. Right? So all of the Calvinists flee to New England if they want their religion to survive. Okay, so now let's say you have a name like Washington or Lee or Custis or Mason or Fairfax. Where do you go? You're a Cavalier and you're worried that the Roundheads are going to take over England. But you want to make sure you can survive with your family, your fortune, your religious ideals. Where do you go?
Virginia.
Virginia. Absolutely. So I hope you guys all see this is critical to our course. Absolutely critical. It is a miracle that the Virginians settled as far away from the Puritans as they did. Because if they had been neighbors, they would have killed each other. Right? What's stunning in American history is not at all that they hate each other. It's that for a moment during the Revolution, they get along with one another in order to fight a common enemy. You have already got the American Civil War in place the moment you have the first Anglican arrive in Virginia and you have the first Puritan arrive in New England. These are the same people who will be killing each other during the American Civil War. Now, their ideals have changed a little bit, but culturally, they're the exact same people. The Northern Army of Lincoln is made up of all the descendants of the Roundheads. And the Southern Army of Lee is made up of all the Cavaliers and their descendants. That is critical to understand this. You will not get American history without recognizing this. So these guys already hate each other. And they come here specifically to get away from the other. That's why they're coming. So anybody want to guess? If you're really wealthy, if you're a Cavalier, think about land law. If you own a ton of land, who's going to inherit it when you die? Only one person gets it. This is European law in terms of land. So I'm a huge landowner and I died. Who gets all my land? Yeah.
Isn't it your firstborn?
Yeah, absolutely. What about my secondborn?
He gets nothing.
He gets nothing. Yeah, get out of here. Right? Sorry, Harry. So Nathaniel gets everything. Harry gets nothing. Excellent. It's over. Well, if you've got all this available land in Virginia, now Harry can have something too. You give your second son land. Now, he's not going to be as important. But if the family folds in England, you've got a safety valve. You can go start your plantation again in Virginia. You're safe. So that's exactly what's going on in America. Virginia is established as a safety valve for the Cavaliers in England if they lose. And they do lose. That's the English Civil War. The Roundheads win. So that's going to be a major problem. So once again, we can't escape that when we're thinking about the Americans. Okay, so I hope that makes sense for everybody. I've got one other thing I want to talk about today, but I hope that's clear. So we're seeing that division. All right, so let's talk then now about the New Englanders and who they are and what they're trying to do. So when we look at New England and the settlement of New England, the first major landing, of course, and you guys have this as our really our opening document for the course. Our first major landing is in November of 1620. By the way, I hope you guys kind of caught it. I'll say this again later in the semester. But there's a reason when Abraham Lincoln declares Thanksgiving as a national holiday, he picks a New England holiday. Right? Those are his people. That's his supporters. He's not going to pick a Georgian holiday. Yeah, that would be absurd in the middle of the Civil War. It has to be a New England holiday, and that's become enshrined in our culture. Now, is there anybody in this class who was not homeschooled, who did not dress up as either a pilgrim or an Indian in first grade? Of course, you know, can you imagine? What if we dressed up as slave and slave owner? Right? That's abhorrent, right? Because we don't celebrate. We're not giving thanks for the South. We're giving thanks for New England. So it's going to be New England food. It's going to be New England culture. That's what we're doing. It's a Puritan holiday. New Thanksgiving is. Okay, so just keep that in mind. So when these people come in 1620, now, there's no civil war yet, but they're moving towards civil war, and they know it. So when these guys come over, they are Puritans. And they're a strange form of Puritan. They're an extreme minority of Puritan. But we have these Puritans who had been living in the Netherlands for a bit in an experimental community there that didn't go very well. And now they're trying to change their experimental community to North America. And they're supposed to land in Virginia, but of course nobody has good maps. And they don't really know exactly where Virginia is, and plus they're civilians. So they don't have great accuracy. And they end up at Plymouth Rock, of all places. So I'll just put this out on the table. My oldest son is sitting in the front row here. And when I grade you guys, he won't get an advantage because I grade blindly. So you'll be okay. Though I know his handwriting. We're going to have to figure something out. But anyway, so one of my favorite stories, Nathaniel was a little kid. And I took him to Plymouth Rock. You remember this at all? And how many people have been there? Okay. So there's the rock, right? It's in that concrete encasement that you have to look down on it. And it has the big stamp, 1620. Nathaniel, being a very bright little kid, said, "Dad, how did the Indians know they were going to arrive in 1620? As if the Indians had carved the number. And think about, I love that, because how often all of us think that way. None of us give much credence to the Indians. It's like they're all just sitting around waiting for the Europeans to come so they can have a life. Right? They've been there for generations. Come on, guys, we've got to get history going. Yeah, and obviously that's not the case. But it's a really important moment that they arrive there in 1620, and what do they find? Crazily enough, there are no Indians in the area, because the Indians had all been wiped out by disease because of English fishermen who had come through the region. So let's say that you're arriving in the middle of nowhere. You're already nervous. You've got families with you. You arrive at this barren spot in New England in the fall. You're a few days away from the first snowfall. That is very nerve-wracking. You've just had 8 weeks on the Atlantic where you want to just lose your stomach every day because of the weather. Can you imagine being pregnant or taking care of a kid on that thing? And you arrive, and you're nervous because, well, what are the natives going to do? Are they going to like us? Are they going to hate us? They're savages, right? So they're going to kill us. There are none. There aren't any there. And so this is a miracle by the understanding of the pilgrims. Right? Obviously, God intended for them to come to this place clear of Indians. But here's the great thing. The Indians in that region were farmers, so they'd already tilled the land. There's land, fresh soil, everything there. There are trees that have been cleared, forests that have been cleared. And these guys come in and they think, oh, wilderness isn't that bad. This is all taken care of for us. But, you know, we know that half of them die the first winter. It's still pretty bad. So it's a struggle. But here's what I want you to think about. So if somebody would, I'd like you to read what we call the Mayflower Compact. Let's just imagine, you know, we've got 140 people on one ship. Little kids, soldiers, families, ministers. But not really, because they're Protestants, so they're each ministers, essentially. So, what page are we on?
13.
So, model of, I'm sorry, yes, 13, thank you. So, somebody read this, what we call the Mayflower Compact. But, thanks, Shelby.
In the name of God, amen. We whose names are underwritten, the loyal subjects of our dread sovereign Lord, King James, by the grace of God of Great Britain, France, and Ireland, King, defender of the faith, etc., having undertaken for the glory of God and the advancement of the Christian faith and the honor of our king and country, a voyage to plant the first colony in the northern parts of Virginia, do by these presents solemnly and mutually, in the presence of God and one another, covenant and combine ourselves together into a civil body politic, for our better ordering and preservation, and furtherance to the ends aforesaid, and by virtue hereof to enact, constitute, and frame such just and equal laws, ordinances, acts, constitutions, and offices from time to time as shall be thought most meet and convenient for the general good of the colony, unto which we promise all due submission and obedience. In witness whereof, we have hereunto subscribed our names at Cape Cod, the 11th of November, in the reign of our sovereign Lord, King James of England, France, and Ireland, the 18th, and of Scotland, the 54th, and Anno Domini, 1620.
Excellent. All right. What a beautiful document. How many people in the world have the audacity to simply say, yep, we're in the middle of nowhere, but we can govern ourselves. It's not a problem. Why? Because we have our Bible, and we have common law. That's all we need. We know how to do this. And this, we think about the Declaration as the founding document of America. This is the founding document of America, right here. Now, it doesn't matter what our religion is. I share almost nothing with these people in terms of my religious belief. But what audacity. It's incredible. They know they can govern themselves. And they do. And talk about America. I mean, I see a few of you with your Kyo letters on. And, you know, think about how often we do. This is what we do as Americans. We don't rely on somebody else. This is the best of what we are. We see a problem. There's homelessness. We create an organization to get rid of it. We see that the town needs painting. We create an organization to get rid of it. We see that this old woman can't take care of herself because she's just in advanced age. So we bring together a few good men. We do this all. Nobody in the world does this like we do. We have our problems, don't get me wrong. But this is our greatest strength. We absolutely know how to form community and get things done. This is what we are. America is a nation of small communities working together. And that's exactly what these guys do. But yeah, we can do this. And you know, even though I don't share the religious faith, you know, I just imagine in 1620, any other people besides the most hardcore Protestants who could have done this. Now, imagine if the Catholics had arrived. They'd have to check with the bishop, and the bishop would have to check with the pope. And you can imagine that they would just have layer upon layer of rules and bureaucracy. These Protestants who basically said, no, we're not going to be governed by anything other than our belief in God, which, again, I'm not saying is correct theologically, but look what they're able to do with it. But yeah, we can do whatever we want, and we're good at it, and they are. Right? They're amazing, and they persevere, and yes, they lose half their people the first year, but they survive. They make it. So those who survive build this colony. And I want you, I hope you guys know this book is yours, right? This is why we don't allow you to sell them back, or I mean, you could, but we want you to keep these as part. We give them to you, you pay for it in your tuition, but we want you to keep it. So I want you to mark this up, and I would like each of you, And I know that for some of you, especially the more Germanic types, this is going to be very hard. But I would like you just to cross out Mayflower Compact. Just cross it out. That is not its real name. Nobody called this thing the Mayflower Compact until 1793. It was the first time anybody used that term. What these people called it, what the Pilgrims called it, was the Plymouth Combination. And that is what you have to know. Now, I may ask you Mayflower Compact, but you all have to know this is the Plymouth Combination. Why? Why is that important? It's incredibly important because, first of all, it's out of Plymouth. That makes sense. But combination is just the English term for covenant. This is not a political compact. This is not like the Constitution. It is a covenant. They are combining and agreeing to live under God's law with one another. This is, I won't say it's the equal of Abraham's covenant, but it is a shadow of it. It is meant to be a shadow of it intentionally. So we use compact that makes it that sanitizes it, makes it seem more palatable, especially to a people who aren't as religious as these were. That's the whole reason that Massachusetts, it was a bunch of historians, archivists in 1793, who said, we're going to start calling this thing the Mayflower Compact because we don't want the Southerners to think we're a bunch of crazy Calvinists. That's why they took it off. But my God, embrace the crazy Calvinism, right? That's who they were. And that's what we have to understand. So this is very much a religious document. Absolutely a religious document. But how effective were those historians? Did anyone in here know it was called the Plymouth Combination? You know, prior, I mean, maybe one or two of you, but it is just not common knowledge. It's the Mayflower, but I bet you all at least knew the Mayflower Compact, right? It's ingrained in us back to that first great moment, right, where we're all dressed that way. But please keep this in mind, how important this is. That self-assuredness is really American. It's just, you don't see it elsewhere in the same way. You have it always in English-speaking countries, but never to this degree. This is really hardcore. Okay, last thing I want to say about this, and then we'll pick this back up and I'll talk more about their theology on Friday, so make sure you've read the stuff that I assigned. But I do want you to notice how they put this in the way that they frame it. So notice that it's all based on the Lord's Prayer. I hope you guys caught that. The exact rhetoric is based just on the Lord's Prayer. You start with sovereignty, our Father who art in heaven. Then you give your petition, right? God, give me my daily bread. And then you end with sovereignty again. For thine is the power, the kingdom, and the glory. Right? We're going to see this, the declaration, even though Jefferson is not a religious man, the declaration is rhetorically exactly the same. It will do the exact same thing. Sovereign Creator, here's our petition. Sovereign Creator, help us. It's always the Lord's Prayer out of Matthew. Okay, good. Any final questions or thoughts on that? All right, it's good seeing all of you. Glad you're in the class. And yeah, we'll start talking about those crazy Calvinists who are actually quite huggable on bread. Thanks, everybody.
So I've got some of that down, but you know.